Hello, Politicos, and welcome to another episode of The Trill, a podcast by The Trillium. My name is Aiden Shimandy. I'm a reporter here at The Trillium. Today, I'm joined by...
Tyler Meredith.
Tyler, do you have any titles that you think dear listeners of The Trill should know about?
I'm a founding partner of Meredith Bosenkohl Policy Advisors, and I'm a senior fellow at the Monk School at the University of Toronto.
Wonderful. And so today we are going to be talking about the carbon tax, because that seems to be just about the only thing getting play in provincial politics over the last number of months, really since the government came out of the Greenbelt scandal last September. So I wanted to start off by talking about the love-in between the Ford government and the federal Liberals. That's obviously gotten a lot of play over the past few years and continues to do so. But we are now months into the Tories hammering one of the Liberals' cornerstone policies. There isn't much going on at Queen's Park other than this, as I said. How much of a fissure in the relationship does this represent in your eyes? Do you expect this to be taken seriously in Ottawa, or kind of with a grain of salt?
No, look, I don't think this is at all surprising. The Ford government has been against carbon pricing since they first came into power in 2018. Obviously, the two governments have been able to work together very successfully on some big things like investments in the auto sector and a few other things. But pretty much every provincial government in Canada, with the exception perhaps of probably the EB government in British Columbia, has been or turned over time into being critical on carbon pricing. So the fact that the Ford government is adding their voice to that, I don't think is surprising or significant to the relationship with Ontario.
And so, like you said, the tax really has been a bone of contention for years. But one thing that really seemed to kick it into overdrive was the home heating oil carve out, which kind of disproportionately affects Atlantic Canada. And so how much do you think this carve out kind of did open the door to this huge wave of provincial opposition that we're seeing?
So I think the mistake perhaps that the Trudeau government, and obviously with some acknowledgement that I, worked for the Trudeau government for about 7.5 years, I think if there's a mistake that they've made in this space, it's that in that announcement in particular, there wasn't a pre-existing policy framework that could justify why that decision was being made. There actually is a good reason for that carve-out that was made, which effectively that if you look at the cost of home heating oil, even compared to natural gas, which is the next source of energy that people have said, well, why don't we add that to the carve-out as well? There's a significant cost differential for people between if you're on home heating oil versus if you're on natural gas by several factors. And so if you're paying a substantially higher amount of your energy costs to home heating oil, and you're getting back an average rebate that's supposed to be the average for everybody in the country, obviously in that particular situation, the carbon price is not going to do, and the rebate is not going to do its job effectively in being able to leave you either equal or better off as the policy is designed to do. And it leaves you without the financial resources to invest in the things that we want you to do, which is to be able to move eventually to a lower emitting and more energy efficient source of energy that perhaps a heat pump, for example, could give you. And so there's a totally good rationale for potentially carving it out. It obviously opens up questions about other forms of home heating, but there's a good rationale to carve it out. The problem is they didn't say that in advance. And the fact that the prime minister had effectively all of his Atlantic caucus behind him made it look like it was completely a political decision. But last point I'll make here, Aiden, is that if you look at the numbers of people who benefit from this, because obviously it is something that applies across the country, just on a nominal basis, in raw number terms, there are effectively just as many people in Ontario who are on home heating oil who will benefit from this as there are in all of the four Atlantic provinces where this will also apply. And so it's true that as a share of the total population in Ontario, they're relatively much smaller, but there's actually a lot of people, over 250,000 people effectively in Ontario, who will benefit from this.
And to your earlier point, we do hear a lot from the Ford government saying, oh, tons of Ontarians use natural gas. Why can't this be a carve out? So moving on to the next question here, we hear so much from really smart people. I'm thinking about recent Globe and Mail piece from McGill's Chris Reagan about how this is a really well-designed policy that most Canadians simply do not understand. So what are your thoughts on the debate on whether this is primarily a communications issue or a policy issue?
So it's a bit of both. I think, again, the government probably has not invested the dollars that it needs to do in a national advertising campaign to actually be clear with people and educate them on what carbon pricing is and what it isn't. And let's also be clear about the fact that carbon pricing is not the only tool as to how Canada is reducing emissions. It's about a third of the overall kind of emissions profile of what of the weight that's being placed on how we reduce emissions over time. And the other important factor that I think a lot of people haven't kind of internalized, because there's often this claim that says, well, why are we doing it if Canada's only somewhere around 1.5 to 2% of global emissions, right? Is it really going to be all that effective? Is it all that effective if we're returning all the money to people anyway? Emissions are actually down, right? So compared to where, if you look at the projection of where just before Justin Trudeau came into power, of where we thought emissions would be in 2020, relative to that baseline in 2014-15, emissions are down, depending on how you want to count it, somewhere in the order of about 10 to 15% compared to what they would have been business as usual without any interventions. So obviously, there's been a lot of different tools that have had to be used. Carbon pricing, one of them. Carbon pricing is the thing that's gathered all the attention. But carbon pricing is only about a third of the effort that's gotten us to reduce those emissions by about 15%. But it is, nonetheless, been successful in effectively taking off somewhere in the order of about 5% of our emissions. That's a success, right? And what's interesting here is that those who are opposed to carbon pricing haven't really put on the table an alternative of what they would actually do to make up that 5% of emissions and to make up that additional component of emissions that we're supposed to get as we move to 2030, as the carbon price continues to rise.
And what do you make of the argument that it really is a competitiveness issue? Like, there's no carbon border adjustments. The U.S. hasn't implemented any real kind of carbon pricing. It's not really it's not really common in Europe and whatnot.
So I think that's kind of ludicrous, because remember that the retail carbon pricing system sits alongside what we call the output-based pricing system, alongside a bunch of industrial specific regulations in different sectors. And when you include the output-based pricing system, which effectively is a way to create carbon trading, a carbon credit trading, and to also hold hold in place high emitting sectors that are also trade sensitive, like steel and concrete and so forth. And when you consider all those other factors, The industrial price in Canada is actually relatively weak compared to the retail price. If there's probably an argument to be made about a mistake that we've made in this whole mix, I would argue potentially it's we've put maybe too much emphasis on retail pricing compared to industrial pricing. And so so from that perspective, I don't think there's a competitiveness problem, because we're actually maybe not weighing enough of an industrial carbon price. And I think this is where there's an interesting debate to be had. As we begin to take apart the retail component, which, you know, depending on what happens with the federal election and depending on what happens with provincial governments, we seem to be on a path to do, will we replace that with an equivalent level of effort on the industrial pricing system? And what is the economic cost of that? We haven't had a debate about that. And I say that because I think if you ask people about what is it that they want, generally speaking, the public opinion research tells you that yes, they would like to not be seen to be paying what they think is a direct cost on their own consumer behavior for the retail pricing system, but they also don't want to weaken our climate change agenda. They don't want to be seen to be weakening our commitments to reduce global emissions and Canadian emissions by somewhere in the order of 40% by 2030. And so if we take off this retail component, again, it's not the only tool that we're using, but if we take off this tool, it's using about or generating about a third of the reductions, we've got to find additional effort somewhere else.
Now, let's put a pin in that for now, because I do have some questions on that planned for later, because there was an interesting report from the Canadian Climate Change Institute, I believe, that came out very recently. And I want to get back a bit to the whole provincial hullabaloo around this, because, you know, I'm thinking back to that famous McLean's cover, story by Paul Wells, The Resistance. Yeah. So we had Ford, Jason Kenney, Scott Moe, Brian Pallister, and Andrew Scheer standing there together in opposition to the policy, even though the photo was Photoshopped. They were not in the same room together. Trudeau seemed to have won that battle back in the late 2010s. I mean, Ford and Moe are the only two resistors still in office. How do you do that? How'd Trudeau manage that?
So I think if you look at the 2019 election and the 2021 election, what they had federally, what they had in common with each other was a trinity of issues in some degree. So in 2019, it was climate change, affordability, and guns. And to a certain extent, 2021 was climate change, affordability, COVID. And I mean, guns was also part of the discussion, but I would argue like the three winning issues were in both elections, two of those three were affordability and climate change. And on climate change, the government was actually able to kind of make an effective argument that said, number one, we have a plan that will make you better off, that will leave 8 out of 10 people the same or better off as a result of the rebate. But two, this is the right and smart thing to do. And there was a very effective chorus of economists, of environmentalists, of people like in 2021, Andrew Weaver, the former leader of the BC Green Party, who all basically said, there's a series of things you need to do in order to have a serious plan to address climate change. And if you don't do those things, you do not have a serious plan to address climate change. And one of those things was you have to have in your program carbon pricing. And in 2019, Andrew Scheer ran on not having anything to do with carbon pricing, running against the what was then a kind of tax to come. It wasn't yet fully in effect. And saying, you know, effectively axe the tax before it gets started. He did not win that election. In fact, there's a lot of evidence that suggests that he pushed votes in the direction of the Liberal Party because of his stance on climate change. 2021, Erin O'Toole comes along and actually decides, I need some version of carbon pricing in my plan in order to be taken seriously, and came very close to winning that election, actually, and did a very good job of potentially taking off a few, liberal conservative switchers who were ultimately at the end kind of held back for other reasons in the liberal fold. But like the Conservative Party actually acknowledged for the first time they need some version of carbon pricing. Now, suddenly, at a time in which we have an inflation crisis, an affordability crisis, and a set of macroeconomic conditions that are not very favorable for incumbents, now axe the taxes back. But I guess I wonder, is this really just a momentary response to this inflation crisis that has suddenly made in this one particular moment carbon pricing no longer popular? Or would we be able to run the same election in 2019 of 2021, in subsequent cycles and still get to a result that kind of has the expectation that you have to have a serious plan on climate change and that has to include carbon pricing?
Yeah, I've been asking myself that same question, and I suppose there's really no way to answer it other than just seeing what plays out in reality. Eh?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, I think the fact that the Conservatives even temporarily changed positions shows you that they knew that they couldn't sustain the argument entirely against it. And, you know, in the end, it may not matter because the tax may go away if a federal Conservative a government is elected. I think it has been interesting that at least for two of the last elections, Justin Trudeau won that argument quite convincingly.
Are there any other parallels, differences in that that example that you think can be, like, any lessons that can be drawn there that we haven't talked about?
Well, I think the critical thing is people still want ambitious action on climate change. And the risk that Conservatives run, and Doug Ford is open to this risk as much as Pierre Poilievre is open to this risk, that if they are not seen as having a credible plan to address climate change, as there is ever more present floods, wildfires, and significant climate disasters happening, I think they will be on the wrong side of history, frankly. And I think the challenge for Conservatives is, as much as it is popular to say axe the tax, and the public seems to be there right now, the public mood seems to be there, what will you replace it with? Will you replace it? Will Pierre Poilievre feel compelled to have to come forward to put out a plan that, for example, compensates what he is going to take off on the retail side and put back onto industrial? I think that's probably the most interesting political question to watch. And I would say, just to the point I made earlier about, like, what were the conditions that made 2019 and 2021 elections successful for Justin Trudeau, and why is it today that he's now facing some struggles on this front? Part of it is because that chorus of voices that were saying, here's what you need to do in order to have a credible and serious climate plan, those voices aren't actually as active anymore. Like, environmentalists are not out there clamoring, saying we've got to defend carbon pricing. They've kind of accepted, I think maybe for different reasons, that they would prefer certain regulatory tools. they've moved off of saying that that's the only way in which you'll reduce emissions. I think that for those who care about having an efficient market-based approach to solving this, which is what conservatives perhaps should care about, that's a worrying sign.
I do think that point about wildfires is very interesting, because obviously last year it was terrible. We were getting flak from the US for this, and I don't think it's going to get any better this year. We've barely had a winter. There's not been much precipitation. I think it's probably terrible for me to say interested to see how that plays out, considering the effect that this has on people's lives, but I digress.
Well, and one thing I'll say about that specifically is this is actually a space where conservatives could be doing a lot more than they are. Because if you decide that you don't believe that it's useful to try to, or effective even to try to address climate mitigate the effects of climate change, there's still a lot you can do to adapt to it, right? To better prepare ourselves for resiliency for the reality that there's just going to be more of these events. Some may say that that's a defeatist attitude, but at the end of the day, it's still going to happen anyway. You need a mix of probably both of approaches. And so, for example, right, there's a real risk that parts of Ontario are going, and parts of the country are going to become uninsurable as we see more and more and more of these major climatic events. And what are conservatives doing about that? To what extent do they care about how to ensure that there are insurance mitigations to be able to deal with those costs that homeowners face? If you care about affordability, which Doug Ford says he cares about, you should be championing this issue, and they're not.
So mention that McLean's piece, and it wasn't just the cover. I did go back and read the story, and there was a really interesting quote, I thought, from Ian Brody, who was Stephen Harper's former chief of staff, that I just want to pose to you, get your thoughts on, and unpack a bit. And he said, "The core political problem, I think, is that it, the carbon tax, falls on households of commuters and is therefore geographically very efficient at alienating voters in ways that are easy to take advantage of in a first-past-the-post system."
That's probably true.
Yeah.
I mean, it's probably, I think to a certain extent that's, there's some truth in that. I mean, there's been some research that shows, for example, and my conservative business partner, Ken Bozenkool, has written about this, that if you decompose the carbon rebate, now we call the carbon rebate, across geographic regions, so between rural, suburban, urban, so people who live in urban centers actually do very well by it, because their costs, right? They don't drive as much. They're more reliant on transit. They may walk to work. They live in high dense neighborhoods. They consume less energy. They do very well because, again, everyone, with the exception of the top up you get in the rural area, everyone's getting an average amount, right, as the payment. And so the average payment has to compensate for all of these different use types that exist. And so it does a really good job of helping people who already have relatively low costs, and maybe not so good of a job of helping people transition who have higher cost bases. And that's why, you know, things like the carve out for home heating oil are actually potentially an important feature or bug that you have to deal with. But what's interesting, right, is that, and this is where, you know, Ken's written a really smart piece, is conservatives could have looked at that and said, well, how do we design a backstop that takes the money that we would be required to raise under the federal pricing system, and instead of giving it, you know, in ways that overcompensate urban dwellers, could you design it in a way that overcompensates his own coalition base in suburban or rural communities? The fact that they didn't even try or think about doing that is, I think, interesting, that they just decided to oppose rather than to propose.
So that quote is kind of a leading question, because I assumed that you would say he was right. And, you know, that commuter part of the quote, the suburban voters, Ford and Crombie are both going after that exact 905 suburban band. So given that Ford is going so hard against Crombie, trying to tie her to the carbon tax, calling her the queen of the carbon tax, what do you think that says about how much Ford might fear Crombie and be trying to, you know, really define her in the early days of her leadership?
Well, I'm not surprised that, you know, obviously he wants to put her in a position of having to defend Justin Trudeau, who's, you know, somewhat unpopular these days. Although I have to say, I've been a bit surprised at the language of queen of the carbon tax, because Doug Ford's going to need female voters to get reelected. And I don't know, I'm not a female voter, but I would suspect some people find that language off-putting. But I'll say this, So he obviously had a very, very intentional effort to put her in a bit of a box. I think she's done a very good job, actually, of trying to step around that box and to reframe the conversation. Now, some people will see what she's proposed doing as, you know, an attack on the federal liberals. I'm not sure it's fair to read it that way, because I think what she's saying is we need to kind of come up with an alternative plan, given that the reason that the backstop is imposed in Ontario is because Doug Ford refused to put forward something that's consistent with the federal pricing system. And the challenge that she has is in that process, and she won, like, I think it's got three tests that she's got to pass. One is, can she do something that outmaneuvers Ford on being able to show that it's not creating excess cost on the consumer in the form of a retail price? Number two, how does she, for progressives and environmentalists, demonstrate that we're not weakening our commitment to a 2030 and a 2050 goal, and that we're still going to be able to credibly meet those goals as Ontario between now and particularly 2030? And number three, how can you do it in a way that's generally consistent with the objectives that the federal government has sent, so you don't piss off federal liberals? And I think to your question about the 905, I mean, I think that first test is going to be important about ensuring that there's no feature of this that looks and feels either like the cap and trade system that Kathleen Wynne put forward, or something that has a retail facing component for consumers.
Why would it be so bad if they went back to a cap and trade system? Because that is something that Crombie said she was potentially open to, while leaving the door open to any number of other possibilities.
I mean, look, I like a cap and trade system. I mean, I think it's certainly efficient and good. I assume that there would be an aversion to want to think about that, just because, you know, it could be easily criticized by Ford as the baggage of Kathleen Wynne. But, you know, look, maybe she wants to take that on. I don't know. It would be an efficient way to do it. Quebec has already got a cap and trade system, and there's an argument to be made to say, well, why don't we align in a way that is consistent with Quebec, and by the way, what California more or less is doing, and by the way, also what New York State apparently is interested in doing as well. And so, you know, you get Ontario, Quebec, California, and New York together. That's a pretty big block of economic actors that could actually do something significant.
And if you were advising Crombie, given the current political environment and what she said about not having a retail price on consumers, what would some of your suggestions be?
So I go back to, I think they need to consider whether the industrial price is something that should be played with, because I think there's good politics there. I think it's good policy. Obviously there will be some competitiveness questions that will be raised about particularly Ontario's manufacturing sector, but that would seem to be, given the objective she said of wanting to remove a retail price, that would seem to be a very logical place to look. The second would be, and this is interesting, is does Ontario want to say or do anything in the border carbon adjustment space? And I only say that because, you know, obviously the Ontario government doesn't have the authority to level a border carbon adjustment on its own. It doesn't have a tariffing power. But there are potentially, and I haven't thought about this too deeply, but there are potentially some backdoor ways that you could construct that. And I think the public actually would be quite open to this, especially in a world in which, you know, we might see a Trump administration want to do this in the United States context as well, because there's obvious opportunities to rebalance trade from some dirtier places in the world like China and India.
So earlier in the conversation, if listeners remember, Tyler and I put a little pin in our conversation about the extent to which the retail carbon price affects Canada's greenhouse gas emission reductions target. And I'm going to pull that pin out now. So for probably the last question. So the Canadian Climate Institute just came out with a report saying that the consumer price would be responsible for anywhere from 8 to 14% of our targeted GHG emissions reductions. The methane regulations, the oil and gas cap, and the industrial carbon tax in particular are a lot more impactful, according to CCI's modeling. So kind of the central question here, is the consumer tax a policy that can be legitimately sacrificed to make the politics of the more impactful policies more palatable?
So potentially, yes, although there's an important caveat about that report that people have to keep in mind. The first part is that each of those different tools matters in terms of the integration with the other tools, right? So the oil and gas cap becomes particularly useful under certain scenarios as to whether or not you have the investment tax credits that go along with it, because it creates incentives to offset and to make the investments necessary to offset the what you would otherwise have to pay under the effectively the cap and trade, the sector-based cap and trade model that's proposed for the oil and gas cap. And so you can't just look at one of those tools on its own. I would argue that, you know, the more tools we layer into this, it becomes super complex. But the point is they all kind of have to work together in a way that's coherent. And if you pull out the retail carbon pricing system and you don't ensure some degree of price signal on the industrial side that's comprehensive and broad enough, then some of the other those other tools and some of the emissions reductions that you will get with those other tools won't be as significant as projected.
So last question is a very simple one. I don't know if you are a betting man. I am not. But come October 2025, when the next election is scheduled, do you think the consumer carbon tax will be as big of an issue then as it is now?
Well, I think we're going to have an election in which it'll be on the ballot. It'll be an important ballot question. The people won't be, it won't be the only thing that people are voting on or about. Likely it will be, you know, is the electorate willing to give the incumbent government that will have been around for 10 years another shot? And is the incumbent government offering a plan that looks like it's meeting people where they are with their needs and issues in October 2025 and not caught in some vortex of 10 years ago? But look, I mean, if we are to believe polls as they are today and the general kind of sense that it's very hard after 10 years to get reelected and incumbents everywhere around the world are under challenge, I think it's likely that we are going to see the retail carbon price probably go away and have to be replaced by other things. And the question will be, what are those other things? Because right now, there's no chorus out there that's really, other than the federal government, that's defending this thing. And I think it's actually unfortunate that the environmentalist community has not stepped up.
Well, that was my promised last question, so I will wrap it up here. Tyler, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it. Really enjoyed this conversation.
It was great. Thanks for having me on.
Listeners, tune in again in 2 weeks. And if I could just do a shameless self-promotion at the back here, The Trillium recently got nominated for a National Newspaper Award for our reporting on the impact that land developers have on Ontario politics. So yeah, that's really it. Thanks. Bye.